The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Why did you leave Rue?
Because I'm afraid for him and of him. He wants the Nephilim.
The child of a fallen angel?
Painting of one.
Why?
I don't know. Rue has never told me. That alone tells me how powerful it is.
Invading the premises at this point isn't the smartest thing we could do. I didn't come here to get arrested for murder.
That would be the least of our worries if Salome gets her hands on that painting.
We have visitors.
All right, kill them.
Hello?
Saladin has me. He intends to trade me for whatever object you recovered. Get Anya and yourself out of there. Run and don't...
Old fool, do you have the treasure?
Yes. And I'll tell you something else, Saladin. If you harm that old man, I will track you down if it's the last thing I do.
What are you doing, Rue?
If you come any closer, if you try to take the horn from me, I'll kill you, Anya. I swear that I will.
Anya, draw your sword! Do it now!
Rogue Angel 13, Gabriel's Horn, from Graphic Audio.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Attention all posts. This is Lieutenant Junior Grade Esme Suiza. Assuming command of the patrol craft Despite, upon the deaths of all officers senior in the chain of command, we're going back.
Junior Lieutenant Suiza, you saved my favorite niece, Commander Saran. And I won't forget that. I'll be keeping an eye on your career, Lieutenant. I think you have more potential than even you suspect.
Graphic Audio presents The Serrano Legacy. By Elizabeth Moon.
It is my duty to inform you that you have all been called before a court. The junior lieutenants can expect to see charges of both treason and mutiny.
Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Elizabeth Demery, Sherry Simpson, Peter Stray, Kate Foster, Scott McCormick, James Konacek, David Coyne, Tom Simpson, Tim Carlin, Jeff Baker, Tim Getman, Mort Shelby, Thomas Penny, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, Sonny Lasky, Jason Stiles, Dylan Lynch, Andy Clements, Ken Jackson, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, and Terrence Aselford. Book 4, Once a Hero, Part 2.
Esme found herself chatting with Baron Serrano even away from the mess hall. They had gone climbing once with the club, and after a couple of hours of sweating on the wall, she could not be shy with any of the climbers, let alone Baron. Then they had found themselves in the same corner during one of the officer socials, simply because Ensign Zintner had cornered a tray of the best cookies and they'd spotted her doing it. Esme did not let herself notice that the nightmares were not as intense on the evenings she spent with Baron and his friends. Instead, she concentrated on what he could show her about the unofficial customs of Fleet. Gradually, she thought of him less and less as that nice Serrano boy, and more as the kind of friend she had not known she wanted. In his company, she found herself making other friends. She began to realize that not all the people who approached her were interested only in her notoriety. Once she began to enjoy herself more, Esme started worrying that she was being too social, neglecting her studies. She felt guilty about going to the gym to play wall ball when she could have been studying. Patak seemed pleased with her progress, but if a ship needed repair right now, what could she actually do?
I still don't know what I should do to help Major Patak.
You're being too hard on yourself.
And I know what I'm talking about. Serranos have a reputation for being hard on themselves and each other, but you're off the scale.
Is there something wrong with having high standards?
Not that high. You're locking down a lot of what you could be, could do, with that kind of control.
What I could do is study.
Oh, come on. We need you. Alana's not feeling up to a game, and that leaves us short.
All right.
Esme realized she was all too anxious to please Baron, and it bothered her. She didn't want complications. She wanted simple friendship. That was pleasure enough. When they arrived at the Wallball Court, most of the players had agreed to play a variable G game. Zintner set the AI control for random changes.
It's more fun, you'll see.
Alana was refereeing this match.
I'm not fond of black eyes. I won't play VG games, and neither should you, Esme.
Oh, come on, be a sport.
Esme shrugged and put on the required helmet and eye guard. The game turned into a wild melee. Balls, rackets, and bodies flew in all directions, bouncing off the walls and each other. An hour later, bruised and sweaty, Esme and the others staggered out to find that they had plenty of spectators. Zintner looked up at those watching through the high windows of the court.
Chickens!
It's easier on you shorties. If all the blood rushes to your head, it doesn't go as far.
Esme said nothing. Her stomach was still arguing about which way was up, and she was glad she had eaten little for lunch. She refused an invitation to take a cooling swim with the team, and instead showered and changed. By then, she was hungry. Outside the showers, she found Baron nursing a swollen elbow.
You are going to have that checked, aren't you, Ensign?
They had discovered a mutual distaste for medical interventions and now teased each other about it.
It's not broken, Lieutenant. I believe surgery won't be necessary.
Good. Then perhaps you'll join me for a snack.
Oh, I think I could just about manage to get my hand to my mouth.
I served on the same ship as Hera Serrano, back when I was an ensign. She was a good officer. I was in awe of her. When she got into that trouble, I was so angry, and I didn't know what I could do to help, if anything. Nothing, as it turned out.
I met her just one time. My grandmother told me about her. Not everything, of course, only what was legal. She sent me with a message. She wanted to use only family as couriers. We weren't sure which of us would find her, and I was the lucky one.
Didn't you like her?
Like her? It's not a matter of liking. It's... Look, I'm used to Serranos. I'm one myself. We tend to have this effect on people. We're always being accused of being arrogant, even when we aren't. But she was... She bought me dinner. She was in a white rage when I first showed up, and then she bought me dinner, a really expensive one, and... Well, everyone knows what she did at Xavier.
But you ended up friends with her.
Baron looked down at his plate.
I doubt it. I doubt she's friends with any Serrano now, though I hear she's speaking to her parents again.
She wasn't?
No. It's all kind of tangled. According to Grandmother, she thought they would help her when Lopescu threatened her. And they didn't. And then she resigned. That's when Grandmother told everyone to leave her alone.
But I thought she was just on covert ops then.
That too, but I don't know when or what was going on. Grandmother says it's none of my business and to keep my nose out of it and my mouth shut.
Esme could imagine that and wondered that he broke the prohibition even this much.
I met her, of course, after Xavier, but only briefly. There were legal reasons for keeping us apart, they said.
Then she turned the topic to something less dangerous. A few days later, Baron asked her about Altiplano, and Esme found herself describing the rolling grassy plains, the mountain scarps, her family's estancia, the old stone-built city, even the stained glass she had liked so much as a child.
Who's your seat in council?
Nobody. We have no direct representation.
Why?
The founder died. The family we served. Supposedly half the militia died along with the family. There are those who say otherwise, that the reason no one from Altiplano has a seat in council is that it was a mutiny.
What does your grandmother say?
My grandmother?
Oh, of course, because his grandmother is Admiral Serrano.
Papa Stefan says it's a ridiculous lie and Altiplano should have a seat, or maybe four.
Baron gave her a look she had a hard time reading.
On Altiplano, we're not like fleet, even if we're militia. Men and women don't usually do the same things. Not as life work, that is. Most of the militia and all the senior commanders are men. Women run the estancias and most of the government agencies that aren't directly concerned with the military.
That's odd. Why?
It's all old stuff. And anyway, that's just Altiplano.
Is that why you left? Your father was a sector commander, you said? And you couldn't be in the military?
Not exactly. Look, I don't really want to talk about it.
Fine. I never asked. You never got upset, and we can just talk about my relatives again, if that's all right.
Esme nodded, stabbing her fork into food she barely saw, and Baron began a story about his cousin. He was being polite. She was the occasion for more politeness, and that in itself was humiliating. That night, the nightmares recurred, as bad as the worst she'd had. Esme woke from the battle for despite, only to find herself in the body of that terrified child, helpless to beat off her assailant. And from that, relived the worst of the time in the hospital. Dream after dream, all fire and smoke and pain, and voices telling her nothing was wrong, even as she burned and writhed in pain.
Ugh, God.
Finally, she quit trying to sleep and turned the light on in her compartment. This had to stop. She had to get sane somehow. The obvious move presented itself, and she batted it away. She had enough bad marks on her record, with the Board of Inquiry and the court-martial, and then that ridiculous award from Altiplano. Let her get a psych note in her record, and she'd never get what she wanted.
And what is that?
She wanted... She would have said safety a while ago. The safety Fleet could give her from her past... But the man who had hurt her was dead, her father's lie exposed. She was safe in that way.
What do I really want?
Fragments popped into her mind, as brief and bright as the fragments of traumatic memory. The moment on the Bridge of Despite when she had given the order to go back to Xavier System. The moment when she'd given the order to fire, and the great enemy cruiser had gone up. The respect she'd seen on the faces of those at her briefing, when even the admirals... Even the captain, in spite of himself, had admired the way she presented the material. Even the admiration of the juniors, which she half-hated herself for enjoying. And more recently, the friendships she was beginning to develop. What Esme wanted was just that. Those moments, and more of them. Herself in charge, doing the right things, using the talents she had shown herself were hers. Recognition of her peers, friendships, life itself. The critical side of her mind pointed out tartly that she was unlikely to have many such moments as a technical specialist, unless she made a habit of serving on ships with traitorous or incompetent captains. She wasn't as good at the technical bits as others. She studied hard, she achieved competence, but not brilliance.
You're too hard on yourself.
Baron was wrong. She was not hard enough on herself.
You're locking down what you could be.
What did he think she could be, that Serrano ensign? He was only a boy. A Serrano boy, her critical self reminded her. So he thought she wasn't using all her talents.
If he knew anything. If.
She could hardly apply for command track now, this many years into technical. She didn't even want command track. She had hated combat from the first moment of the mutiny through to that last lucky shot that burst the enemy cruiser like a ripe seed pod. She pushed down the memory of the feeling that had accompanied the fear, the sick disgust with the waste of it, that feeling entirely too seductive to be reliable. Who knew what they felt at such times anyway? Perhaps she could go into teaching. She knew she was good at presenting complex material. That history instructor had even suggested it. Why had she fled from that offer into those concerns? Her mind thrashed around like a fish on a hook, unable to escape the painful reality that she had trapped herself stupidly, blindly. Like a fish indeed. She who was meant to swim free.
But where?
The next morning, Esme was tired enough that Major Patak eyed her closely.
Late night, Sweeza?
Just some bad dreams, Major.
Patak held her gaze a long moment.
Lots of people have post-combat dreams, you know. No one will think less of you if you talk them over with someone in medical.
I'll be all right, sir.
Patak kept looking, and Esme felt herself flushing.
If it gets worse, sir, I'll keep your advice in mind.
Good.
Esme started to relax.
If you don't mind telling me... What made you choose technical instead of command track?
I didn't think I would be good at command.
In what way?
Well, I'm not from a fleet family. There's a natural feel.
You honestly never wanted to take command of a unit until you ended up with Despite?
No, when I was a child, of course I daydreamed. My family's military, we have hero tales enough. But what I really wanted was space itself. When I got to the prep school, there were others so much better suited.
Your initial leadership scores were quite high.
I think they gave me some slack for being planet-born.
Esme had explained it to herself that way for years, as the leadership scores dropped bit by bit, until Xavier's system, until the mutiny.
You're not really a technical track mind, Sweeza. You work hard, you're smart enough, but that's not where your real talent is. Those briefings you gave the tactical discussion groups, that paper you wrote for me, that's not the way a tech specialist thinks.
I'm trying to learn.
I never said you weren't trying, but think of it this way. Would your family try to make a draft horse out of a polo pony?
For some reason, the attempt to put the problem in her culture's terms made Esme stubborn. She could almost sense her body changing, long dark legs and hard hooves sinking into mud, leaning backwards, resisting.
If they needed a load hauled and the pony was there, I see your point, sir, but I never thought of myself as a pony mismatched to a load.
I wonder what you did expect.
A place to work. Away from Altiplano.
It was the most honest thing she could say at that point, without getting into things she never intended to discuss with anyone, ever.
Young woman, this fleet is not a place to work away from home.
Oh, I didn't mean just a job.
I should hope not. Damn it, Sweeza, you come so close, and then you say something like that.
Sorry, sir.
And then you apologize. Sweeza, I don't know how you did what you did at Xavier. But you had better figure it out, because that is where your talent lies. And either you use your abilities or they rot. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Clear as mud in a cattle-trampled stock tank. Esme had the uneasy feeling that Baron wouldn't be able to explain this one, in part because she would be too embarrassed to ask. Later, Major Patak stepped into Commander Ceviche's office.
I put the bug in her ear.
And?
And then I nearly lost my temper and pounded her. I do not understand that young woman. She's like two different people, or maybe three. It's not like anything I've seen before, and I thought I'd seen every variety of strangeness that got past the psych nannies. She's all there, and then she isn't. I tried to get her to go talk to Med about her combat experience, and she shied off as if I'd threatened her with hard vacuum.
We aren't the first commander she's puzzled. That's why it was such a surprise.
One good thing is she's coming out of her shell with some of the other juniors. She and that Serrano ensign and some others.
The young Serrano? I'm not sure that's a good idea. There were two Serranos at Xavier.
I don't see a problem. This one is too young. Those were much her seniors. Besides, they're not plotting, they're climbing the wall and playing team games together occasionally. My thought was that maybe the Serrano arrogance would get through her shell, whatever it is, and release that natural command ability.
Maybe. She's not seeing just him, you say?
No. I hear about it mostly from young Zittner, who plays wall ball with him. She says Sweeza hates variable G games, but it's a good sport. I haven't asked, but she's told me that two or three young men are pursuing Sweeza. Without much success. Not really a cold fish when you get to know her, but reserved, is what Zittner said.
She must be hiding something. They always are, the juniors, even when they think they're not.
And we aren't?
We are, but we know we are. The advantages of maturity. We know where our bodies are buried, and we know that anything buried can be exhumed, usually at the wrong moment.
But Sweeza...
Let her be for a bit. See if she gets somewhere on her own, now that you've planted the idea. We've agreed she's not stupid. She'll be here a couple of years anyway, and if she hasn't unstuck herself by the end of the next review period, we'll try again. If, as we said before, life doesn't give her the necessary kick in the pants.
Esme stared at her work, feeling resentful. She knew that was an unsuitable feeling for any junior officer, even if justified. In this case, it wasn't even justified. She liked Major Patak and trusted in her honesty. If Patak said she didn't have a technical mind, then she didn't have a technical mind. She tried to ignore the self-pitying self that wanted to whine about all the hours of study, the diligence, the self-sacrifice.
stupid!
She looked up, startled, at Master Chief Sivers, who had come in to bring something to Major Patak.
Sorry, I was thinking about something else.
That's all right, Lieutenant.
Chief, how can you tell which junior personnel are going to have a knack for technical stuff?
Sivers gave Esme a look that clearly said this wasn't her business or his, but then leaned back against the bulkhead.
Well, some of them come in with such a genius for it, you don't have the slightest doubt. I remember a pivot 6 or 7 years ago, straight out of basic, who had blown the top off the placement exams. Well, we'd had high scores before, but this kid couldn't touch something without making it work better. In 2 days, we knew what we had. In a decade, we were just holding our breath, hoping he wouldn't get crosswise of anyone important. Because he did have a way of speaking his mind. That was before we were on course, you understand. She was under construction, and we were working out at the Sierra Station. Major Patak was a lieutenant then, same as you are now, except she was herself, if you know what I mean. Well, this kid snapped back at her one day, and she went the color of bad polyglue. Then she blinked, and looked at me, and said the kid was right, and walked out. Told me something about both of them. Thought, of course, I had to give the kid what for sassing an officer. Wasn't really sass, he just knew what he knew and didn't bother to hide it.
And the ones that aren't quite that good?
Well, I can tell the ones that'll work hard, of course. That always helps. Anyone with enough smarts to pass the placement exams can learn enough to be useful if they work at it steadily, the way you've done. But nothing replaces the knack, the feel. I can't explain it, Lieutenant. Either they have a feel for the material or they don't. Some of them have it real narrow. They may be technical geniuses in scans, say, and useless for anything else. Others have a knack for a lot of things in the technical area. They can work almost any system.
Are you ever wrong?
Sometimes. But usually it's not to do with their talent. I've missed other things about them, things that interfered. I remember a Sergeant Minor transferred in from Sector 11, scores off the chart. That was odd in itself. Why would another sector let him go if he was so good? But we were short-handed, like we always seemed to be, and he was awfully good.
So, what was wrong with him?
Pure meanness. Turned out he got his kicks making trouble. On his own crew, in barracks, everywhere. Set people against each other, skinned the truth to the bone, but always in ways that he could explain as not really lies. Nothing he did was against regulation. He was careful about that, but by halfway through his tour, we'd have done anything to get rid of him. I would, anyway. I'd just been promoted to Master Chief. I wanted my section to run smoothly. And here he was stirring things up. Well, we finally got rid of him, but it wasn't easy. Then there was a kid who was smart enough when he could keep his mind on the job, but he was always in emotional hot water over something. Or rather, somebody. We finally got him to medical, and they had some treatment, but then he wanted to transfer. I heard later he was doing fine over in Sector 8.
Sivers gave Esme a smile as he pushed himself up and started out.
Just keep plugging away, Lieutenant. You're doing fine.
So even he knew she wasn't that good at this. Esme resisted the childish urge to throw something at that broad back. At dinner that evening, she said less than usual, listening to the chat at her table. The self-proclaimed genius of special materials research wasn't talking either. He had the abstracted expression of someone trying to solve problems in his head. Baron Serrano was describing his attempt to recalibrate a grav scan in which, as he put it, someone had been tap dancing on the connections. He sounded happy enough, and the jig at the far end, talking about her current love affair, sounded even happier. Perhaps it was only lack of sleep that made her want to crawl under the table. She had had nightmares all night, and a confusing and disappointing talk with her commander. Of course she felt down. She didn't eat dessert, and decided to go to bed early. Arhas Asperson looked at his partners across the table as the wand blinked.
Found it. It's a tricky one, too.
Not too different from what we were told, I hope.
No, but apparently the captain's a bit paranoid, moves it around from time to time, and checks out the circuitry periodically to make sure it works.
So we have to fix it with a built-in test circuit to fake the test?
Yes. I've got the details. Amazing how some of these people will talk if they think you sympathize with their problems. There's a petty light who's convinced the captain is down on him because of a practical joke actually concocted by someone else. He was so anxious to convince me how unfair and unreasonable Haken is that he practically handed me the whole mechanism on a chip.
So when can we do it?
The captain tested it 2 days ago. He's using some schedule of his own devising, but he's never yet tested it within 5 days of a previous test. So if we do the main part tomorrow, that should give us a few days to test the test, as it were.
I hope this is all right. I mean, we're stuck on this ship now, and we can't pretend we don't know what it's for.
I can. In anticipation of immortality, I can pretend any number of impossible things.
But if the Blood Horde shows up...
Here? Where our very efficient escorts will chase them into the arms of the neighboring cruisers? I refuse to worry. There's nothing we can do. As far as I'm concerned, there's a dangerously paranoid captain on this ship who might at any time see a dust spot on a vidscan and decide it's an enemy fleet, and then decide it's his duty to blow us all away. While I'm on this ship, I particularly want that device out of his control, lest I lose my chance at a long, happy life because of some knot-headed captain's mental quirk.
You're not happy about it either.
Yes, I am.
No. Every time you get flowery like that, it means you have doubts. Serious doubts. I think we ought to put the controls in our own hands.
Not a bad idea. If nothing else, it will keep you satisfied. Gory?
I like it. What time tomorrow?
Well... the easiest access will be through the inventory bay on Deck 10, the one across from T4, and there are weapons components in that bay.
How fortunate. Especially since the computer indicates they're located exactly in the right place.
You fiddle, Darhaas.
What use to have the ability if no use is made of it? It's true that I transposed some numbers in the database, but it was in a good cause.
I hope so. I do hope so.
With their most advanced equipment, they were able to locate and fox the scan, which supposedly kept anyone from tampering with the device. It took a day or so to create the blind loops they'd insert while they worked. Another day or so to create a convincing errand in that bay again. Then they were in. And the device, in its casing, looked just as they'd expected.
The tricky bit.
Rapidly, the case came open, the controls yielded to their intrusion, the codes changed, and the telltales stayed a friendly green.
Might as well run the test.
Might as well. We've got 10 minutes.
Arhas nodded to Losa, who pricked her intercept into the captain's control line and then inserted a 2-layer code. The telltales changed in sequence from green to yellow. She inserted another code, and they went back to green.
Lovely. I really do like it when we're right the first time.
If we were right.
3 rejuves low. 3 first class, guaranteed with the best drugs. We were right.
Arhas finished cleaning up, putting everything back as they'd found it. Even to the tiny piece of metal filing that just happened to have lain a 0.5 centimeter in from the right front corner of the case. Then he backed out, wiping the deck behind him.
We're going to live forever and be very, very rich.
That night, they brought out one of their treats from home and toasted each other. For the benefit of the ship's scan, they congratulated themselves on their progress so far in getting the weapons rekeyed. It made a delicious joke. Arhas sank into sleep and dreamed of the future, when he would be so rich and so well known that he'd never have to take a Blood Horde contract again. Esme was asleep, having a different dream for once, when the alarm brought her upright even before she woke. All down the passage, she could hear people moving around. Her heart stammered and she felt cold sweat break out. But as she dressed, the nature of the emergency became clear. Ships coming in for repair. Not a mutiny, not combat. Not, she told herself firmly, as bad for her. As Esme scampered along the passage and up ladders to her section, she felt the gut-twisting lurch of a ship overpowering its way through a jump point. Fear crawled back up her spine, vertebra by vertebra. DSRs were not built for racing and jumping. DSRs moved at the leisurely pace appropriate to their mass and internal architecture. She understood now, after the time in Holland architecture, why it wasn't a matter of adding more power,
what the trade-offs were in making Kosciusko so big and so massive. What had happened? Where were they going? And more important, were they fleeing with trouble on their tail or running toward it? Holland Architecture, like every other section, swarmed like a kicked anthill. In the departmental briefing room, Commander Ceviche was putting a cube in the display.
Ah, Suiza. Hook up your compad. This is going to be interesting.
Esme plugged in her compad and made sure it was set to record the display directly. Most of H&A was in the room when Ceviche started his briefing. The rest straggled in within a few minutes.
This is what we know, and we all know that it will be worse. Wraith is a patrol ship commissioned 10 years ago out of the Dalvery Yards, one of the SLP Series 30 hulls.
Esme now understood the groans. The SLP Series 30 had well earned the nickname Slippery, meaning its architecture lent itself to unauthorized and possibly damaging revisions.
She's been in combat against the Blood Horde, and despite their technological inferiority, they managed to wipe most of her scan systems and then bludgeon her with heavy explosive. There was shield failure of the starboard arc, forward of frame 19, with resulting damage to the forward weapons pods, and a hull breach here.
Ceviche's pointer circled the intersection of frame 19 with truss 7.
She was lucky in some respects. They knocked out her scans, but not the scans of her hunting partners. Sting and Justice were in the system, and they blindsided the Blood Horde ships and drove them off. Wraith had heavy casualties, of course, but they were able to patch things up enough to make it through one jump point. They couldn't manage, too. The hull patch was leaking again, and they had nothing more to use on it. So, as you all no doubt felt, we're jumping out to meet them.
No one said it this time, but the tense faces around Esme revealed their thoughts. DSRs stayed well behind any line of war for a very good reason. They couldn't fight, maneuver, or get away. If they were attacked...
I did remind our captain that old Koss isn't an escort... But we should be fine. Half our protection jumped ahead of us, and the rest will jump with us. We'll have Sting and Justice as well. And it looks like all the experimental stuff on Justice worked.
How long do we have?
Ceviche looked at the chronometer.
We expect to come into the same system in 78 hours and 18 minutes. We'll be making a series of fast insertion jumps coming out of the last at a slow relative V. They'll tow Wraith out to us. We won't know more about the hull damage until we come out of the last jump. We're pushing this ship to its max, and not hanging around anywhere to pick up messages. For all we know, Wraith won't make it until we arrive.
By the time Kosciusko came out of its last jump, Esme had been all over the ship on errands for Major Patak.
Don't be insulted, but you still don't know enough to be really useful. And I need someone to keep up with all the other departments. Ship's comm is overloaded, or will be.
Esme didn't feel insulted at all. She was quite willing to check with inventory control on the stock of fasteners, to ask the chief in weapons systems for an estimate of the damage that Wraith might have suffered from its own weaponry exploding when the hull breached, to crawl around the depths of the storage hold full of structural members, checking each one with instruments that should detect any dangerous deformities. She had always avoided medical, in the superstitious belief that any wandering psych nanny would see in her face that she had terrible secrets, and she'd be out on a psych discharge before she could argue. But in the last hours before they closed with Wraith, Patak sent her there to coordinate the search and rescue with what was known about the hull and its problems. Medical occupied a large chunk of T5, with onboard operating suites, decontamination suites, regen tanks, neural-assisted growth tanks, isolation chambers for exotic infectious diseases, diagnostic labs, the equivalent of a sector hospital. Esme found it in the same state of bustle as her own department, and was passed from one desk to another until she located trauma response. Esme handed Patak's cube of data, updated since the down jump by direct transmission from Wraith, to the lieutenant in charge of the extrication and trauma transport teams.
Hang around until I'm sure we understand all this.
He stuffed the cube into a reader. The display came up on the wall. The others milling around settled to look at it.
Forward hull breach. That'll mean decompression injuries in the nearest compartments beyond the breach.
In the breach itself, it meant deaths, the responsibility of personnel salvage, not extrication and transport.
Looks like truss failure here. We'll have to cut our way around that. Lieutenant, what will happen if we cut here and here?
He pointed. Esme pointed to alternative cuts already on the cube display in green.
Sir, Major Patak believes it would be safer in terms of structural integrity to make the cuts here and here.
That'll just barely give clearance for our suits. We don't want to snag on anything, and we'll have casualties coming out. We need more room than this. We've told H&A before, we need a solid 2-meter clearance. Why can't we make this cut?
The lieutenant pointed again at his first choice. Esme thought she knew, but this was a job for someone with seniority.
I'll get Major Patak for you.
Do that.
Esme found Patak deep in one of the holds stocked with H&A gear and patched her through to the E&T commander, then backed off as the air heated up around her.
And if you want several dozen more goddamn casualties and a lot of sharp-edged frickin' ejecta floating around, then you go on and cut to your heart's content.
Damn it, Major!
Now, what do you need for your suits? I'll get you space, just tell me.
2 meters.
Huh, all right. I'll send Sweeza back with a new plan that'll give you 2 meters. Round section or square?
Square would be nice, but round will do. If we're only one, it wouldn't matter,
yes,
but...
Yes, well, if the Blood Horde were recruits on a first mission, Wraith wouldn't be full of holes. I'll get back to you.
Patak turned on Esme.
Why are you looking so surprised? Didn't know I could turn the air blue, or didn't think I could calm down? Either way, it looks bad. Don't just stare at me, Lieutenant. You're making me nervous.
Sorry, sir.
2 stinking meters they want. Idiots. I suppose they can't be sure what they'll find in there, and they need space. But they certainly can't cut that one. If I lend them a structural tech to do the cutting, that shorts me on the main job. But it might save some lives and shouldn't cost any. All right, here's what you tell them.
Patak rattled off a series of contingent plans and sent Esme back to the medical deck. Esme wanted to ask why she didn't just call them on the comm, but this was no time to ask Patak anything. 8 hours before the last jump point, Esme and all but essential crew went down for a forced rest period, augmented by soporifics in the compartments. Esme understood the reason for this. Exhausted, twitchy people would make unnecessary mistakes, but she hated knowing that her calm repose had been created chemically. What if something happened and those awake forgot, or had no time, to turn on the antidote sprays? She was still worrying at that when she woke, feeling rested and alert, to the downshift alarm. It had worked, as usual, but she didn't have to like it. The Kosciusko had emerged at near zero relative V to the system it entered, the safest way to dump something of its mass out of jump space. Before Esme could get back to Patak's office in H&A, word had come down that Wraith's tow was within 20,000 kilometers. That made not only a bullseye, but a potential disaster.
An error of considerably less than a tenth of a percent in exit V, and we'd have romped right into her and her damn fool escorts. But it does mean we can get to work quickly. Might save a few survivors in the forward compartments.
Tight beam comlinks were already up. Real-time data poured into Kosciusko's communications shack to be decoded and routed to the relevant departments. Esme spent the first hour or so watching the H&A data and sending it on to the subspecialists. Then Patak found another job for her.
Troll the stuff they're sending drives and maneuver and special materials. You're good at picking up connections. Someone upstairs may have misrouted something we need.
Patak herself had a model of the SLP Series 30 hull set up in both virtual and wireframe floor versions in the briefing room. Around it clustered the senior H&A engineers, making changes to reflect the peculiarities of Wraith as the data streamed in. Esme looked up often to peek at the progress. She had seen plenty of computer 3D displays of ship hulls, but never the scaled-down wireframe that now occupied a 5-meter length of the floor. It looked like fun, though the empty space along one forward flank had nothing to do with fun. She wondered if it was safe to set up for repair so close to the jump point exit lane. What if someone else came through? That wasn't her problem. She shook her head to clear that worry away and went back to scanning the topics routed to SpecMat. There. That was her concern. A request to schedule the fabrication of 420-meter crystal fibers. She checked the origin. If it wasn't someone in H&A, Patak wanted to know. And it wasn't. It was a damage assessment specialist aboard Wraith,
who wanted them to replace some communications lines.
Major, I found it, sir.
Aha! Good for you! No, dears. You don't get to pick your own priorities.
Patak flagged the item, then sent it on to Commander Ceviche's stack.
They always want to, though. They think they're helping us, figuring out what they need when they don't realize the sequencing problem. We can't start anything in the spec mat until we know everything we need at the structural level.
What will come first?
Anything this badly damaged requires rebuilding from the main structure on out, just as if it were new. My guess is that the first things we'll want out of spec mat are much longer crystals, grown in clusters and resin bonded in the zero-G compartment. But the communications linear crystals come later.
I see.
Esme felt she understood much better why Patak had her doing this apparently unimportant job. She knew a lot more about hulls than she had, but this matter of sequencing repairs had never occurred to her. It made sense, now she thought of it.
Sweeza, how would you like a little adventure?
Adventure?
I need someone to do a visual survey of the hull breach, and everyone I've got is busy. You'll need EVA gear. Go over with the first teams, carry a vidcam and transmitter, and record everything for me.
Yes, sir.
Esme hadn't done EVA since the Academy, and that was from a training shuttle hanging just a kilometer from a large station in sight of a habitable planet. Out here, even the local star was far away, hardly a disk at all and giving minimal light. Kosciusko's brilliant lights flooded the near flank of the Wraith, casting sharp black shadows. Esme tried not to think of the nothing around her, and the way her stomach wanted to crawl out her ears, and looked instead at the damaged ship. She hadn't seen the outside of a ship with her own eyes, rather than vidscan, and it was instructive. Like most Familius warships, Wraith had a long, rounded profile that could have been confused with aerodynamic design, but was instead the result of a compromise of engineering constraints. Shield technology dictated the smooth curves. The most efficient hull shape for maximum shield efficiency was spherical. But spherical ships had not proven themselves in battle. It had been impossible to mount drives, either in-system or FTL, to provide the kind of reliable maneuverability needed. The only spherical ships now in service were large commercial freight haulers, where the gain in interior volume and ease of shielding from normal space debris was worth the decreased maneuverability. So a patrol craft like Wraith had a more ovoid shape, giving it a distinct longitudinal axis. Forward, its bow should have been a blunt, rounded end, only slightly pointier than the stern. What Esme saw instead was a crumpled mess, the shiny glint of fused and melted skin where it should have been, as the undamaged hull was, matte black. Aft, the smooth curves of the drive pods appeared to have suffered no damage, though she'd heard that drives and maneuver was worried about the effect of jumping with an unbalanced hull. Esme dared to look over her shoulder, even though that twist made her swivel around the safety line like a child's toy. Kosciusko's vast bulk blocked out the stars well beyond the banks of searchlights that held the patrol craft in their gaze. She wasn't even sure where the working lights on its exterior became stars against the dark. Someone punched her shoulder.
Right. Get on with the job.
Esme pulled herself along, taking no more sightseeing looks. Wraith's damaged hull inched closer. Now she could see the pale tracks of fragments. Of the weapons or the hull itself, she didn't know, against the dark, normal hull coating beyond. The entry gaped, jagged and unwelcoming. Something whispered against her suit helmet, and she jerked to a halt. A firm tap on her shoulder sent her on.
Oh.
Her brain caught up, and she realized it must be minute ejecta from the breached hull. Probably ice crystals from the continuing air leak the crew had not been able to seal completely. Esme hit the red section of the line, only 10 meters from the attachment. Ahead of her, someone had already clipped on the first of the branch lines that would frame the working web. But this was Esme's station for now. She locked the slide on her safety line, clipped on the secondary stabilizing line that would confine her rotation to one plane, and waved the others past. With the vidscan recorder aimed at the hole and the work going on, she could avoid thinking about where she was. Major Patak wanted details, Esme hung in her harness and worked the recorder's eye along the edge of the hull breach. She spent a few minutes on those pale tracks on the way the hull peeled back there to expose a twisted truss on the odd bulge forward of the breach. By the time she'd filled half a cube from that location, the scaffolding crew had placed the major grid lines that would define the location of specific damage sites. Esme signaled her intention to the chief, received permission, and clipped on to one of the cross lines. Really, she thought, it wasn't that bad out here. Once the stomach adapted to zero gravity, it was kind of fun, scooting along the line with only an occasional tug. A red tie bumped her hand, and she grabbed. Her arm yanked at her shoulder, and she spun dizzily.
Move slow, you idiot.
When she got herself straightened out again, someone's helmet visor was turned her way. She could imagine what they thought.
Another dumbass lieutenant learns about inertia.
Esme would have apologized, except that they weren't supposed to use the suit radios unless it was a real emergency. She was now on the opposite side of the hull breach, nearer the bow. From this angle, she could see into the hole better, or the searchlights had found a better angle. She forced herself to look in, but she didn't see any bodies. The mess inside all looked mechanical, like a child's toy that had been stepped on. Slowly, recording, she made sense of it. The forward bulge came from a separation of the forward framing members. They had sprung like an old-fashioned barrel ring under concussive force, and the shattered truss had gone with them. Patak would want to know how far forward the bulge extended. It could be mapped from Kosciusko if no one was using the near scan, but someone would be. Esme looked at the bulge and wished she could ask the Major. If she could get on the other side of it with the recorder, but there was no scaffolding line there. She had four additional lines slung to her own suit, just as all the scaffolding crew had, so it was only a matter of setting the hooks. She left the big vidscan behind, without admitting to herself the reason. She didn't intend to come loose and drift away. It was just good sense to leave the vidscan where it would be easily found. The one built into her helmet would do well enough for this short excursion. She clipped the end of one of her long lines into the 10-meter safety ring, then edged along the scaffolding line to the hull itself. Her short safety line slid along the scaffolding line on its ring. The scaffolding line was anchored with a double pin and patch. She ran her long line through the ring that attached there, which took longer than simply clipping in, but was more secure. She put a boot on the hull and tested. Nothing. She had halfway hoped that Wraith's internal artificial gravity would give some adhesion, but it might not even be functioning. She could put short stick patches on her boots, or she could just go on. It would be easier to go on, and she could always put the patches on if she couldn't make progress. She fished a stick patch out of her tool band with her right hand, positioned it on the end of her gloved middle finger, and gave the slightest push with her left hand. She slid to the end of her safety line, slowly. Reaching out cautiously, she touched the stick patch to the hull. It adhered just as it was supposed to. Now she could stick a pin to the patch, she hoped. She left her right hand on the stick patch and fumbled for a pin. There it was. When she reached over slowly, her safety line tugged at her waist. She had definitely gone as far as she could go with that on. She got the pin stuck to the stick patch with its own quick-setting backing, then opened a connecting ring, locked her long line into it, and clipped the ring into the pin's opening. The next move had a certain finality. When she unhooked her safety line from the scaffolding cable, she was depending on her own ability to set patches and pins. Caution reminded her that she was not a specialist in EVA work, that she would not have the right reactions if something went wrong. Esme grinned at Caution, alone inside her helmet. She had listened to Caution, and what good had it done her? First, they thought she was dull, and then they thought she was a wild radical. It wasn't that different from climbing the rocks at the head of her valley or the exercise wall in the Koss. Reach, place a stick patch, a pin, clip into the pin, move past that protection to the next. 20 pins along, and she was beyond the bulge of damage. Though the bow shield outlet access points, which should have been smooth, glossy nubs protruding a few centimeters from the hull surface, were instead jagged-edged holes. Esme turned up the light on her helmet vidscan to examine them more closely. Something glinted ahead of her. More debris, and surely Major Patak would want a picture of it. She placed another pin, clipped in carefully, and finger-walked herself nearer. Then tried to push herself back and made a move violent enough to fling her off the hull to hit the end of her line. She tried to swim herself into a position where she could see, where she wouldn't be flung back into the hull.
What if there are two? Is that what I think?
Even if it was, it could be the Wraith's own weapons, by chance stuck to its own hull by some reaction Esme couldn't begin to understand.
Mine.
It was a mine. Exactly like the ones in the handbooks of enemy weaponry she'd been looking at in the supply ship on the way to Sierra Station. Meanwhile, she reeled herself in, hand over hand, coming in too fast to her last clip. She bumped the hull with bruising force and would have bounced free except that she grabbed the pin and outward line in one hand and the inward line with the other and let her arms take the strain. Now she wished she had stick patches on her boots. It seemed she hung there a very long time, bouncing back and forth. Finally, the oscillations died down. With great care, she reached inward for the next clip, then unclipped from that pin.
22.
27 pins in all, each requiring slow, careful movement to pass. She thought several times of using her suit comm unit. But was that mine an emergency now? If no one else approached it before she warned them, and the scaffolding crew was still setting up their workspaces in the hull breach. When she made it back to the scaffolding cable and clipped on her safety line, she felt it must have taken a half shift at least. But her chronometer didn't agree. Barely an hour had passed. She retrieved the big vid scan and looked around for the scaffolding chief. She couldn't go back to the Kosciusko without warning someone here. She spotted him at last and edged from line to line until she could tap his shoulder, and then the message board he carried. His helmet nodded. Quickly, Esme drew a clumsy sketch of the bow, the bulge, then the location of the mine. "Mine," she printed in careful letters. He shook his head. Esme nodded. He pointed to the big vid scan and drew a question mark. She had to shake her head and point to the scan lens in her helmet. "Follow," he signed, and led her along the scaffolding to a comm nexus. While she was gone, they'd strung a direct line from ship to ship and passed a wire into Wraith so that the ships could talk without unshielded transmission. Esme and the scaffolding chief both hooked their suits to the nexus.
"What do you mean, mine? And what were you doing that far up the bow anyway? Your safety line isn't that long."
"You saw the bulge of the damaged frame. I went to scan it for Major Patak. I put out stick patch pins and clipped in. And when I got beyond the bulge, I was scanning damaged shield nodes, turned up my suit scan lights, and there it was."
"A mine, you say?"
"It looks like the illustrations in the handbooks. Not one of ours, either. A Smedic Series G is what it looked like to me."
"What kind of fuse? Did you see that?"
"No. I tried to jump back and lost contact with the hull."
"So you don't have full documentation?"
"No."
"Well, hell. You had to report it, and if it is a mine, we'll have to do something."
The chief looked at her. She was an officer. It was her job to make decisions.
"This is what I get for throwing caution to the wind."
Esme tried to think who to report this to aboard Kosciusko. The simple answer was Major Patak. But an enemy mine stuck aboard a ship under repair wasn't simple. Esme finally got Patak on the other end of the connection.
"You think you saw a mine, an enemy mine, and you may or may not have gotten it on the vid?"
"Yes, sir. I pushed off too hard. I was afraid."
"I should hope so. You know, Sweeza, you do have an instinct for drama. An enemy mine. Not everyone would think of that."
"Think?"
"Thinking is good, Sweeza. Now the first thing you do is tell the chief to get his crew the hell away from Wraith. Then you get your butt back out there and get some decent vid scan of this putative mine. I hope you have enough air."
Yes, sir."
"That's reassuring. Now I'll go tell our captain to tell Wraith's captain that a totally inexperienced junior officer on her first real EVA thinks she saw an enemy mine stuck to his ship. And while she didn't get any good pictures the first time, she's now taking pictures which, if the mine doesn't blow her up, may show us whether she's right. And give us a clue how to do something about it.
Yes, sir.
That did not require an acknowledgement, Sweeza. Can you think of any mistake you haven't made yet?
I didn't set it off.
All right, Sweeza. Send the crew home and go bring me some decent pictures. I'll see what I can do to scare up a bomb squad.
Esme didn't wait for the crew to leave. She fished out stick patches for her boots, checking twice to be sure she had the kind that would not adhere permanently. Then she used one of her safety lines and extra clips to sling the big vidscan on her back. This time, the trip was easier, with the pins already in place and the grip of her boots on Wraith's hull. She didn't look at anything but the pins, the clips, the line itself, until she was almost at the 20th pin. Then suddenly, light flooded over Esme from behind, washing out the fainter light from her helmet, and she missed the pin. When she turned to look, her helmet visor darkened automatically. She could see that one of Kosciusko's big lights had turned away from the hull breach to search along the bows. Evidently, Major Patak had reached the captain. She reached again for the pin and clipped into it safely. In the brighter light, the edges of the shattered shield nodes cast jagged shadows that striped the hull's dull black. Things looked different now. She couldn't see the mine, but it had to be close. Another pin, and another, and another. Esme jerked to a halt and slammed her feet into the hull. A light flashed red in front of her. Emergency.
Oh.
She leaned her chin on the comm unit switch.
Lieutenant, don't move. Look down. Knee level. 10 o'clock. But don't move.
Esme looked down, half her gaze cut off by the helmet. Something moved. Something small, perhaps the size of her ungloved fist, dark and glossy, rising on a thin wire stalk that gleamed in the searchlight. She wanted to tip her head and see where it was coming from, though she knew without seeing.
Just don't move. With any luck, it will think you're part of the ship.
Esme opened her mouth to ask.
And don't talk. We don't know what its sensor characteristics are.
The little black ovoid on its wire, the programmable sensor pod of a smart mine, rose higher. She could see it clearly now, and presumably it could see her. Sweat sprang out on her whole body at once. It tickled abominably as it rolled down her ribs, down her belly. She wanted to scratch. Not as bad as she wanted to run.
I am part of the ship. I am an automatic repair mechanism. Turned off at the moment. Non-functional.
Esme tried not to breathe as the sensor swayed nearer, sweeping in a conical pattern dictated by the stiffness of its wire stalk and the vibrations induced at its source. She had been a Scantech. She knew what that deadly little package might contain. It could already have matched her thermal profile to that of human in EVA suit, if that was part of its programming. It could have recorded her skeletal density, her respiratory rate, even her eye color. And if it had done all that, she was already dead. She just hadn't been killed yet. The little pod on its stalk continued to revolve, but it was lower again. She didn't know what that meant.
Would a smart mind bother to retract its sensor array before blowing up?
Esme could barely see it now, above the sight rim of her helmet. Then it was below her vision. She was not tempted to bend over and look more closely.
Sorry, Lieutenant. Our searchlight brought your shadow up past its threshold. But you were dead right. Sorry, bad choice of words. But it's definitely a mine, and definitely an enemy weapon. We've got a hazardous equipment assessment team on the way. Just don't move.
A few moments later, the tremors began behind her knees. She struggled to control them. How sensitive was the sensor pod? Reason suggested that she'd been moving more before and it hadn't reacted. But reason had no control over her hindbrain, where panic danced its jig on her spine. She was very bored with being that scared by the time the voice spoke again.
You put down a good line, Lieutenant. Don't move. We're at the next pin. We can see you clearly.
Esme wanted to turn and see them, see something friendly, even if that was the last thing she saw. But she did not move.
We're afraid if we douse the spotlight, that'll trigger another search sequence, and we don't know how it's programmed.
Esme remembered that some mines were set to go after a specific number of searches had been triggered, even if they didn't find anything. She might have triggered an earlier search when she first flung herself away from the thing.
If we're lucky, it's looking for a match to something specific, which we don't resemble, but...
Esme wished the voice would shut up now. What if the mine reacted to minute vibrations carried through someone's suit? Even hers? Surely they had someone watching it. Surely they had a plan.
Wraith's given us an update on what's beyond the hull breach. They're evacuating personnel now. How's your suit air? Give me a one-letter answer. A for ample, S for short, C for critical. Then a number for minutes remaining.
Esme looked and was startled to see how far down the gauge had gone.
S. 16.
I'd call that critical myself. Look, here's what we'll do. Someone's going to come up behind you, trying to match your profile, and cast the same shadow, and pop on an external reserve. Don't move. He'll do all the hooking up from his end.
Yes, sir.
Esme's eyes had locked onto the air gauge. The number flicked down to 15, and it was definitely in the red zone.
Breathe slowly. You're not doing any work. You may have longer than that.
Fear burns oxygen. Esme remembered that, along with other pithy sayings. It was amazingly hard to breathe slowly because you needed to save oxygen. She tried thinking of other things.
The mind sensor pod feel the vibration of the person coming up behind me?
That kind of thought didn't help her take slow breaths. She tried to send her mind back to her valley, that favorite and reliable relaxation exercise. But then the gauge flicked to 14.
Don't gasp. Don't look at the gauge. It will either go down to zero, or it won't.
Esme did not feel the vibration. What she felt first was a tiny push that made her sway forward. She stiffened against it. Then something tapped the back of her helmet, and a new voice spoke in her ear.
Doing good, Suisa. Just don't wiggle while I get this tank attached.
Random bumps and prods, which she tried to resist so that she wouldn't move enough to trigger the pod's notice. She eyed her oxygen gauge. 9. Had she really been standing there waiting more than 6 minutes? Apparently so. The gauge flicked down again to 8. Esme braced herself as her unseen rescuer tried to hook up the auxiliary tank with the least possible movement.
Gauge?
7.
Damn, it's supposed to... Oh.
Esme didn't know what that O meant, and it infuriated her as she tried not to watch the gauge. It seemed a long time, but it hadn't flickered down to 6 when the indicator whipped over to the green section.
Gauge?
Green.
Number?
147.
Good. Now, I'm gonna hook into your telemetry. You've been out longer than your suit's rated for.
Esme didn't care. She was breathing. She would not run out of oxygen.
Get your internal temp low. Turn up your suit heater.
She complied, and warmth rose from her boot soles. The tremor she'd been fighting to control eased. Had it been only cold and not panic after all? She wanted to believe that, but the sour smell of her sweat denied it.
We have a problem, Suiza.
Oh yeah? Join the club.
If that's the only mine, if it blows up, it will probably damage only those forward compartments. Oh, and you, of course. We haven't spotted any other mines, but we can't figure out why there's only one. If there's only one.
I sure hope they don't expect me to figure it out.
It's not like the Blood Horde to do that, but there's no doubt that the ships that attacked were Blood Horde ships. Came right in for the kill. Wraith got unequivocal scan data, and then broke off when Sting and Justice closed and started raking them.
Esme wondered about that. By rumor, if a Blood Horde group closed with prospect of a kill, it would not break off just to avoid contact with another ship. Unless its ships were having trouble, she wished she could see the scan data herself. Not likely if the mine blew, but she decided to dare a transmission.
Were they close enough to plant the mine by hand?
Don't transmit. If it hears you...
You wanted to know why. Is Wraith scan tech available?
Wait.
Esme could imagine the scene in Kosciusko's communications shack. Perhaps Major Patak was there. Certainly the captain was.
You can upset him, Lieutenant.
She wasn't sure what it meant. She shrugged enough to move the shoulders of the suit.
You got an idea, huh? Good for you. I can't figure out why that thing hasn't blown us both, but I'm willing to live with that.
Esme felt her own stiff face relaxing into a grin.
Suiza, just in case you've got an idea, we've patched you through to the Wraith Senior Scan Tech. Just try to keep your transmissions short. Do you understand?
Yes, sir. Did the Blood Horde ships come close enough for an EVA team to plant the mine, either by hand or by pod?
Yes, I suppose. We were trying to rotate because of the damage to the starboard shields and hull. They got pretty close.
Esme wanted to yell, "Numbers, dammit!"
Numbers, dammit!
Fortunately, the next transmission gave her the figures she wanted. Close enough indeed. Her mind raced through the equations for both EVA and pod movement.
How soon after did the Blood Horde ships pull away?
As soon as Sting and Justice came back.
How soon?
Esme waited, confident in that background bellow. Sure enough, the tech came back on with the precise interval. Esme felt as if someone had run a current down her spine. Maybe they'd spotted the fleet ships before they were fired on, or maybe they hadn't. They'd planted a smart mine, programmed for a specific task, and then they'd gone away, leaving Wraith damaged but not killed.
Why? What did the Blood Horde expect to happen next?
A damaged Familius military vessel would not be abandoned, so they couldn't have hoped to capture it. In fact, if they had, why mine it? Damaged Familius vessels went to dockyards or DSRs, like Kosciusko. What would the Blood Horde know about DSRs? Whatever was in the public domain, certainly. And Esme knew that the public knew DSRs were capable of taking the smaller fleet ships into the DSR's vast central repair bay.
The Blood Horde chose a small ship to disable, planted a smart mine, then withdrew so that Wraith would lead the way to a DSR. The mine's programmed to go off when Wraith enters a repair dock. It's not strong enough to destroy it, but it would probably be unable to make jump.
Certainly unable to make jump.
And it would be immobilized for attack. Either they followed Wraith and her escort to this system, or the mine will also have a homing module to lead them here. They want the DSR, almost certainly for capture, since they could have covered Wraith with enough mines to blow the whole DSR if they'd wanted.
It makes sense. Never thought the Blood Horde were that sneaky. And what do they want a DSR for? Unless they've got significant battle damage somewhere.
They don't have a military-grade shipyard or advanced technical skills. They want a DSR to upgrade their entire space effort. In one blow, they get manufacturing facilities, parts, and expert technicians. Given a DSR, they could upgrade any of their ships to fleet equivalency, or quickly learn to manufacture their own cruisers.
Of course.
Which means this thing won't go off until the parameters match whatever they think the inside of a repair bay looks like, or until someone tries to remove it. It doesn't know it's been detected until we try to do something about it.
Relief weakened Esme's knees. She leaned back against the unseen person behind her.
Which means we can walk away and it won't blow. As long as we don't put Wraith in the repair bay.
Not so fast. You still need to get a good scan on it.
Not active. But yes, I can do vid scan.
Without waiting for orders or permission, Suiza moved, leaning over to aim at it. There it was. The blunt-ended cylindrical shape, the little sensor pod on its wire now retracted to form a knob on the cylinder. She could pick out a serial number and one of the swirling shapes that meant something in the language of Athar's world. Probably something rude. The outside of Blood Horde ships were usually decorated with slogans intended to shock and frighten their neighbors. She patched the vidscan signal to her headset and waited.
That's enough. Now the guy behind you is going to withdraw.
A final tap on her shoulder, and then she saw the shadow cast by Kosciusko's light waver as he left. The smart mind sensor pod didn't move. Curious, but welcome. She waited a little longer, watching her oxygen display count the seconds and minutes, then lifted one stick-patched boot from the hull. The sensor pod stirred, rotating on its wire stalk.
The sensor pod's moving a bit. How about dousing the light while I get loose?
We were afraid the change might trigger something.
If it's programmed for repair bays, then light will activate the matching program, but dark will turn it off.
The light behind Esme vanished, and with it the crisp shadow she'd cast. She turned up the sensitivity of her helmet scan and just made out the mine. The sensor pod did not move. Slowly, she folded herself up as much as the EVA suit allowed so that she could grip her safety line close to the pin and kick the other boot free. No movement from the sensor pod. Slowly, she worked herself hand by hand backwards around the curve of the hull until she was out of sight of the mine. Then she stuck her boots onto the hull and walked back to the line connecting Wraith to Kosciusko. There, the specialists of the bomb squad waited for her, in the strange, bulky suits she had seen only in training cubes.
Suiza, come back to Kosciusko.
Yes, sir.
She wanted to know what the bomb squad was going to do about the mine. Now that she was here, she might as well stay. But the voice in her ear had left her no options, and she'd need another auxiliary tank to stay out longer.
Good job, Lieutenant. Glad you figured out it was safe for me to come back.
Me too.
Esme then hooked herself to the transfer line and pushed away. By the time she had clambered out of her EVA suit, she felt like collapsing in a heap on the deck. The undersuit clung to her nastily. She hated having to stand around in it while the chief in charge of suits examined and checked off the condition of the one she turned in. After one glance, she ignored the big mirror at the end of the bay. Her hair looked like dirty felt glued to her head. Showered and properly dressed once more, she headed to the compartment number waiting in her message bin. T1, Deck 9, number 30. That was in the administrative area of the senior technical schools, down the passage from Admiral Levadi's office. The conference, when she got there, consisted of Captain Haken, Admiral Dossignol, Admiral Levadi, Commander Ceviche, and Major Patak from Holland Architecture, and two lieutenant commanders she did not know. One wore the insignia of the 14th Heavy Maintenance, with the collar flashes of weapons systems. The other, also with weapons collar marks, wore the armband of ship's crew. The captain spoke first.
Well, Lieutenant, glad your guess about the mine's programming turned out to be right, at least as far as you were concerned.
Me too, sir.
Esme hoped the edge in the captain's voice had as much to do with the situation as with her.
I don't suppose you've had time to figure out how we're going to evacuate Wraith and repair her without triggering the mine's recognition program?
No, sir.
Haken was definitely displeased with her. That frosty glare could mean nothing else. Commander Ceviche glanced quickly at Admiral Dossignol.
What I'd like to know is how much time delay is built into that program. Would they have sent it open-ended, or would they have built in a hard delay for just this situation?
Eyes shifted to Esme. Shrugging was inadvisable in the midst of that much brass, so she just stayed quiet. Dossignol looked at Admiral Levadi.
Do we have any Bloodhorde analysts aboard?
Not really, Sai. They pulled the best for some sort of policy strategic planning thing back at Rockhouse, and the next best is on the flagship with Admiral Garrosh. I got an instructor for the tactics course, but his specialty is benignity history. He's hitting the databanks.
Abandoning Wraith is not an option. The Admiral's made it clear that we are not to give the Bloodhorde any chance at advanced technology, and even stripped, that hull has too many goodies to let it fall into the hands of the Bloodhorde, or even a random pirate. If she can't be repaired well enough to get her back to safety...
She can be. This is exactly the kind of damage we're equipped to repair. The only question is how to do it safely, without risking the integrity of this ship.
Admiral Dossignol glanced at Commander Ceviche.
We have to repair that hull breach and reset the engines or she won't make jump again. And that means working all around that mine, even if we don't stick her into the repair bay. I'd like to hear from the weapons experts.
The captain nodded at the crew weapons officer.
Given the kind of mine, there are several approaches we can use, depending on the amount of damage tolerable on Wraith.
Wraith's already got enough damage.
We realize you want to minimize any further damage, but there's a trade-off between safety and speed here. We can get the remnants of Wraith in to repair faster if some additional damage is acceptable. If not, we're looking at a long period of preparation in an already damaged ship. Dangerous time for both the workers and both ships to attempt something which may not be possible.
Explain what procedures you might use.
Ideally, we detach the mine and fold it in a foam mold casing and set it off at a safe distance. However, we, Lieutenant Commander Weitch and I, believe that there is considerable risk of detonating the mine if we try to detach it. So the next best thing is a foam bed, both interior, behind the hull where it's attached, and on the exterior. Here, the problem is how much of the interior needs to be foamed, and that homing signal we suspect, though that depends on what kind of signal it is.
How long before you can set it off?
That depends on what H&A tells us. Commander Ceviche, will we need to foam bed the interior as well? How much additional damage would such a mine cause?
With a gesture, Ceviche passed the question to Patak.
There's already so much damage forward. We're going to have to replace most of the structure anyway. On the other hand, it's stretching our resources, especially if we expect an attack. Do you think it's an aimed charge or just a straightforward blow-em-up?
If they went to the trouble of hand-placing this thing, I'd bet on a directed charge, probably with substantial penetrating power. It's definitely a hullcracker.
But if they wanted to disable the DSR, wouldn't the charge be directed outwards?
Not necessarily. An explosion of that magnitude in the repair bay could be expected to damage sensitive equipment, certainly enough to keep us from withdrawing Wraith and closing the bay. Sorry, but I think you'd better foam bed the interior, at least these compartments.
Patak called up a display and highlighted some of the forward compartments.
If we can possibly save these, 17A, 18A and B, and 23A, it'll save us considerable time on the repairs.
Then, with the precautions we need to protect personnel, we're talking 96 hours to foam bed those compartments and the exterior.
Why the exterior?
Because we don't want pieces flying around hitting us, or the rest of Wraith.
And I'll need additional squads. More people, the faster it'll go. As long as they're not working in close, it should be safe enough.
Very well, Commander. I presume damage control would have personnel trained to spray a foam bed?
Yes, sir.
Captain Haken turned to his exec.
Make sure he gets what he needs. Major Patak, can H&A do anything to expedite this?
Yes, sir. With the captain's permission, I have construction crews standing by to widen access to the compartments that must be foamed. They've been clearing debris already.
I thought we pulled everyone out.
We did, sir. But when tactical analysis concluded that the mine had its programming set for our internal bay, I sent them back over.
Very well. Keep me informed.
With that, the captain rose. Everyone stood as he left. Patak beckoned to Esme.
Lieutenant, you're not ready to direct a crew in this kind of situation. I want you to hold down the office, be my communications link. I'm going over myself.
Yes, sir.
Patak started down the passage. Esme followed.
You'll be in charge of expediting the transfer of materials and tools as we need them. I've set up a model in my office, but it'll need modification. They always do. Keep in mind the limited staging area on Wraith. We don't want things backing up there.